Conquer the Noise is a podcast produced by Unconquered, an independent agency challenging brand perspective to redefine content. This podcast is dedicated to telling stories of outstanding ideas and people who have found their way amongst the chatter.
Hi, everyone. This is Jonathan Hansen, Chief Creative Officer at Unconquered, and I'm your host of Cultivating Purpose and Passion in Business. Thank you so much for tuning to our 15th episode of Conquering the Noise. And I really hope this has been an informative, inspiring podcast as you think about your business, self, and how it all rolls into creating a more purposeful and sustainable future. I would love to hear from you, so please head on over to the Apple Podcast app and leave a review. You can also email me at j@weareunconquered.co. It takes less than a minute and it means the world. Today, we're speaking with Nancy Taylor and Hannah Franco, founders of Epoch Evolution.
So Nancy, Hannah, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you taking out the time. How are you two this morning?
Good. I know Nancy just rolled in from a nice bike ride, so I'm like, we're on the right track.
Yeah, I had to clear my head with everything that's going on in the world today, so it was good. It's good to start out the bike ride.
Exercise is one of those things that is just, it's so wonderful for that. I have not been, I have to say, for my resolutions that I've set, I have not been sticking to them. Dry January ended a day in, and and my exercise routine kind of died with that. What else do you guys do to kind of keep your head straight? I know, you know, you're in startup world. I guess anytime you're running a business, truthfully, it's kind of hectic, but especially in the early years. So you're a cycler. What do you like to do, Hannah?
So in my past life, I've taught a lot of yoga, I would say like for the last 10 years. And so I've been, got a pretty decent home practice, and I'm a big fan of meditation, which I actually think is taking over in terms of importance right now in getting my mind grounded. And I just want to say to anyone out there, like trying to meditate, you can meditate for 5 minutes and that'll do. Like, I think that people get caught up in trying to make it this big thing. And I'm like, 5 minutes, you know, works wonders.
So, for the listeners who aren't quite familiar with your brand, I would love it if you could just, one, give a quick pronunciation of the name as we went through, and a little backstory on how you got to the name and why you started the brand.
Yeah, so the name is Epoch Evolution. And so just channel your inner French girl. Just think La Belle Epoque. Put on your beret, tilt it to the side. And then the origin of the name came from, you know, the conversations we were having about sustainability and the foundation of our brand. And we, you know, found the word epoch and realized that, you know, it means a moment in time. And this moment in time needs change, hence evolution. So a moment in time to change. So here we are, always evolving.
You know, looking at the style of the clothing you guys produce, it almost has, there's sort of like an athleisure aspect to some of the pieces. Are you channeling your yoga and cycling into and some of your outdoor activities into the brand's sort of aesthetic and purpose?
Absolutely. Like comfort was king in our lives, but we love fashion and we love the style of everything. And what we really realized is that, you know, fashion and high fashion, it's just not comfortable. And what was happening in the active apparel space and the innovation of fabrics was everyone from fashion was coming down into that world, but no one from that world was going up into fashion. And so we saw this huge opportunity of, like, I want to walk around feeling like I'm wearing my leggings all day, but I don't want to look like I'm wearing my leggings all day. I want the comfort and ease. And I love wool. Like, my smart wool hats that I ski in, cycle in, do all this other stuff. I'm like, what do we use? Like, merino wool is sustainable. It's amazing. It's antimicrobial. You can wear it 4 or 5 times without having it, you know, really stink and smell up. And when you, like, when you travel, I want a really chic looking shirt out of this, like, you know, wonderful merino wool fabric that I could wear for the same trip. And I have done that. I've worn the same top like 5 days in a row on like a 7-day traveling trip when you could travel. But those were the things that really drove us. And then Hannah was traveling. She was traveling. I'll let her tell the story of this. And we all met up just to regroup before we started the brand for a little reprieve in Morocco. But Hannah showed up, and I'll let her tell that story.
I love this one. So I had been living between Italy and Israel and just moving all around Europe for work, for, you know, design work as well as teaching yoga. And we met up in Morocco, and I have been traveling on planes, and, you know, EasyJet has very like tiny luggage requirements, and I hate schlepping things. So I had packed for 4 weeks of travel in a backpack, you know, that was like a foot by a foot. It was really small. So I show up in Morocco. Nancy's like, where is your bag? You know, we're going to be in the mountains. It's going to be snowing. Then we're going to be at the beach. And then like, we're going out, you know, like, how are you prepared? And I was like, I'm just very efficient. And I remember sitting on the rooftop with her and, you know, drinking a bottle of rosé, having genius ideas as we normally do. And we were like, God, what if there were like a wardrobe that actually worked for your whole life, from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m., from working out to going out to, you know, going to work, and everything functioned for all of those things, and everything was really easy to care for, and everything was really comfortable, and it was sustainable. We're like, let's just put like our bucket list together of clothes requirements. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's sort of the beginning of the story.
Yeah. And I was always of this philosophy of, you didn't need like 10 pairs of pants. You needed the one pair of pants that you couldn't wash enough to get back on. Because we all have those in our wardrobe. But like, this is, you know, it's the one that you feel confident in. You walk out the door and you just always know that that's going to fit in every situation. So that was kind of the grounding impetus of the brand, of giving those core chic basics. And then we also realized is that in the responsible, sustainable world is that a lot of the pieces just weren't really following fashion. They just were a little less forward. And we knew that there was this opportunity to marry them both. And we use the term chic and eco. Mm-hmm. You can be chic and you can be eco at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me kind of like the New York philosophy of dressing, because when the people were going into the office, you would wear usually black because it's something that translates all day. You can go from office to dinner to drinks. And New Yorkers don't really go home during the day. Once you're out, you're out. So you have to kind of wear clothes accordingly, which is going to be able to transition through all these different parts of the day. So I can definitely relate to that struggle, especially even in traveling. I'm a huge traveler myself, and I hate packing, like having huge bags and schlepping them around. And depending on where you're going, if you're more of the adventure traveler, it's even more of a pain, because then you're already in probably not necessarily always the most comfortable situations or travel situations. So when you pack, I have to ask, are you a roller? Do you roll your clothes? Is that your key to getting everything into a 1x1 foot bag?
I sit on my suitcase. That's what I do. I just sit on it. I pile it all in, and it's for me, like, I'm a minimalist except for shoes. I love shoes. I have this weakness, but it's always the second pair of shoes or the third pair of shoes that I want. I have to sit on my suitcase. So yeah, definitely a sit on sweater.
I'm all about packing cubes. If you can like fold really efficiently and like get them in packing, it also like curtails your appetite. You're like, oh, these things need to fit in this packing cube. I guess I have to stop now. But then it keeps like really organized, because of course you're packing and unpacking. So, you know, you need to make sure that it like goes back in again, and it like just helps keep it all organized.
Yeah. So the other thing that we realized when we were starting this is that both of us were traveling for work quite a bit. Uh-huh. And I really realized that what made my suitcase every trip was a very small edited philosophy of where it went. Mm-hmm. And during that time period, that was what I needed. And it kind of translated even in the pandemic time that you just don't need a lot. Mm-hmm. You need the things that function for you. And so we also use this other term called functional fashion. Mm-hmm. So it's pieces that function. Like, are they going to be able to work for her for multiple events or things in her life? And how is this going to be? And so that's another kind of tenet that really seated us in launching the brand.
Yeah, I definitely got that vibe from looking through your work and just reading and diving into the brand, realizing that it seems like you really do embrace a philosophy of purchase with purpose. And when I say that, I mean not necessarily because of the sustainable aspect to it, but the aspect of buying things that last, right? It's like kind of the opposite idea of fast fashion, where We buy cheap clothes. We expect them to be cheap. We're going to wear them for a season and then just get rid of them. They're just in the bottom of the closet. It seems like you've really taken the opposite approach to that. What inspired that? Is that just part of the sustainability aspect of the business, or where did that start before? Is there roots for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'll let Nancy talk to this too, but when we thought about sustainability, we used the word responsible. And so, you know, obviously the raw materials are a key element. Then you have the manufacturing that's a key element. And then you also have the people that work within the manufacturing that's a really key element. And then you have, you know, the care on the other end. And then you have how long you own it for. And so we wanted to take all those different steps of the process into consideration. Mm-hmm. I think they all make up what is responsible, because there's not one tidy with a bow answer to the perfect sustainable solution. There mm-hmm. just isn't. It's a gray area, and we want to make sure that everyone is moving forward to evolve the parts that they can.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really honest answer. I think a lot of brands these days are really greenwashing and trying to make themselves look super clean and perfect and like there's no mistakes. And when you really look at it, it's really not the case. There's a lot of, anytime you're building a business or trying to do something different and build and start with change, there's a lot of unfamiliar things and a lot of risk. Or I don't want to use the word risk taking, but there is some risk involved. It's more of like a calculated risk. So it's one of those things that I think is I really appreciate about what you're doing. And I think it's really important that you're using the word responsible and sustainable. And I think there's quite a difference there. Just for the purpose of this conversation, I would love to hear what your definition of sustainable is. And we talk a lot about it with ourselves within our own business at Unconquered. We also talk about with our podcast guests. And I would love to hear like what sustainable means to you.
I think a lot of it is with the best practices. We really wanted to look at not just the raw materials, but the people, all the components that are making it and putting it all together. Mm-hmm. And so we look at all different levels. It was harder than what we thought too when we first started out. Like, it wasn't black and white. There was a lot of gray in the area. And mm-hmm. we didn't want to say we were perfect. We were saying we were trying and that we were always trying to be better. Mm-hmm. So part of the sustainable is, you know, what are the raw materials look like? How are they produced? So it may not be a recycled fiber to begin with, but the factory that is making the mill that's making it has a lower carbon footprint, fiber footprint than what somebody who's just using recycled materials in Asia and shipping it over here would be. So it got a little complicated and we had to look at the full picture. And then we don't work with a factory we haven't walked into. We have to visit them and see the people. And one of my favorite trips, I sent Hannah this photo after walking into a new manufacturer. And she goes, "What's that?" It's like just a bunch of garbage. And I go, no, look at this. This is where they are. They literally will recycle the paper pieces from the pattern away from the fibers. And they all get reused and put back into it. It was much easier to sweep up the pile and just throw it away. But they would separate those and make sure that it was back in the system. And mm-hmm. those are the partners that we work with. So I feel like that is a huge part of it. And I think we have a responsibility of how we talk to the customer and we talk about the use and the care. I think dry cleaning, the toxic chemicals that are used in dry cleaning and that whole process is something that doesn't need to be here anymore. Like, you can definitely care for your products and use raw materials where that doesn't cause things. I mean, those are just some of them. And Hannah's just as passionate about it. Do you want to add some more that I missed, Hannah?
Yeah, I feel like overall, our definition of sustainability is reducing harm, reducing waste, staying open to change because things mm-hmm. will keep evolving, and, you know, sharing what we know. So educating, I would say those are kind of like the elements that go into all of our decision-making. And I think that Nancy really just clarified that beautifully in practice. Like mm-hmm. when we're looking at something, it's like, how do we do all of those things? Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, next question, how do we do all of those things? And then that answer may have changed from the first time, you know, we hope it has. I'm excited for us to be outdated in our practices.
So I'm really curious, what some of these decision-making processes like. What's been the one of the more difficult ones you've had? So I'm sure as you've started, always starts with a great idea. But then when it comes down to executing it, little roadblocks pop up, or you realize, this part wasn't as easy as we thought. So what are some of those early?
I mean, early ones, raw materials. I thought it would be just easier to find them. And it was hard for us to get the quality we wanted and where it was. We would go to, fabric shows that were pretty renowned, and it was like a needle in a haystack. We'd find one. And then we are still very tight on our fabrics that we use, because we want to make sure that we're putting a functional fabric that's sustainable and offering that to our customer base. So we very slowly grow those offerings and make sure that it functions. But that one was really, really hard. And then, believe it or not, like, packaging was really crazy, because you're shipping this out. So we found this wonderful partner, the Better Packaging Company, and they're from New Zealand, and they have a compostable bag that was our aesthetic. Black, a little bit of white print. It's really cool. So we've used them from the beginning, but then we had the shipping labels. The shipping labels gum it all up. And so they have just released compostable shipping labels. Then you figure the tape of how people return it to you. It's just all of that processes down to the smallest logistics were things that we really wanted to offer a minimal packaging that looked elevated, but yet set within our sustainability monitor. But those are like the top two that I felt were hurdles that I didn't anticipate having. Hannah, what else for you?
I mean, they land more on the marketing side of things. I think that, Nancy and I both come from a background of design, so we've definitely had to learn on our feet how to communicate. And I think as a digital business, that landscape is literally always changing, always changing. Everything from, what's going to resonate with the customer in terms of, videos and photography and models, to, what are the channels that we want to show up on as a brand, and how do we maintain good storytelling there? The questions about the things that are difficult as a startup is so long. I hardly know how to narrow it down.
And I think we have to be willing to climb a mountain every day to educate customers. And that has been a bigger hurdle for her to understand the concept and the pricing and the structure of how we're doing it. And my mission is that you can't affect change without education. So we have that. We put full transparency, all the information we can on our social media channels. We try to bring the customer along. And there's still a lot of pushback. They don't understand it. They want that, the $8 t-shirt that comes at a very high cost, that they don't understand that they're paying $8, but then the long-term cost is much higher.
Yeah, you, both of you, I want to thank you for taking the conversation where I was actually just trying to steer it. So that was beautiful. I was really going to focus next on marketing and education. I agree. I think those are really difficult things. And after spending some time on your website, it's pretty comprehensive as far as the information you're providing along the different materials, the different types of cotton, the different wool, the mills they're produced in. And that's a lot to try and get people to one read, and also do it quickly, because our attention is always being pulled every millisecond to something else. So what platforms are you finding to be for your customer base and your audience to be the most receptive? Do you think Instagram is being helpful? Do you find it your emails? Where do you kind of get a chance to really capture their attention to help with that educational side of it?
I mean, I would definitely say that Instagram is the most effective channel for us, because it's a two-way conversation, which is awesome. I get so excited when there's comments on our ads or our posts asking about where it's made or how much it costs. Cause I'm like, great, we have an opportunity to have a conversation about this. And I think that's really where the education happens. And then I would say the things that we found work really well is also, doing videos that sort of show people how to continually style and restyle and restyle and restyle old clothes. Mm-hmm. We use a lot of our old products in our ads so that people are like, yeah, that thing you bought last season, it's still cute. Just layer it this way this time, So I think that there is a lot of opportunity for us in that particular channel. I mean, our emails are definitely a space where we get to share the why behind everything. A lot of our why we made it emails break down each product, and we're like, okay, here's the whole point of this thing. Here's the whole reason why we decided to make it. Here's the fabric. That's why that's important. Here's this certification. That's why you need to know this thing about it. So that hopefully people can feel more empowered to make those decisions wherever they're shopping. Now people know what GOTS certified cotton is. Now people know what Okotex is. And so that's sort of been our mission through our emails. I am always sad because I'm like, why isn't there more traffic to our fabrics page and our factories page? But I understand you only get so much attention. Mm-hmm. But we are really excited to be sharing the information and resources that we do have. It will only help lift up everyone else who's trying to move the sustainable movement forward.
But I think
the partners that we pick too, like their passion around their facilities and how they are sustainability is amazing. Like, they get so excited to share their visions with us. And then we had one of our main factories just move to a new facility, and how they build it was unbelievable with solar power and a lot of wastewater management, all of that go into it. And it's exciting to share that vision with our customers as well.
Yeah, I definitely think sometimes it's really an information architecture that can help get your, if you're trying to get other pages, more attention, more eyes, at least on the website. Just throwing that out there, as someone who works a lot on that side, and also just making sure a lot of your content can link back to that page. And I think you also touched on a really great point, which is certifications, which is really, I think, like one of those things that the proof's in the pudding there, more or less. What kind of certifications are you going after? Do you have any specifically for the brand, or are you more or less looking for the sort of materials you're sourcing are certified?
I mean, a combination.
We have certifications.
Go ahead.
I'll just go high level, then I'll try to say that. We have certifications from both the factories they work with and their mills. And then for us as a brand, we're working with whatever tools that are available. The unfortunate side of B Corp certification and a lot of these larger ones is that they're extremely costly, and the manpower and the resources that it would take for us to go through those hoops, we don't have it as a small startup. And so one of the best advice we had early on was, you don't have to be certified. You just have to do it right. You have to make the right decisions. And so for our brand as a whole, we choose our partners. And if we have somebody that can calculate some of our usage, which we've had periodically along the way on certain products, it's been amazing. Mm-hmm. But we're just doing it right. Like, we're choosing to do it right. And along the way, as we grow, and if we can get more resources and manpower and be able to measure that, and that is a goal, an objective for us. So Hannah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you covered all the things I was going to say. Perfect.
Yeah, you're right, though. It is really expensive. It's becoming a certified B Corp for us is a goal of ours. It's something we've been reading and pursuing, but it's very time consuming. And, we don't have 100 employees and have one person that we can just dedicate to do it. So it's sort of, it's for us, it's actually like the year goal for us is hopefully by end of year. It's one of those things that, we want to chip away at it over the course of the year. It's like, I do agree. It can be really difficult for earlier businesses to do it. And that's one thing I would love to focus a little bit on this conversation too, is talking about the sort of actual business side of fashions. I find it kind of a mysterious beast in some ways because of previous years. And I know things are starting to change with seasonality. Then there's inventory, and then there's cash flow. Managing all that and making sure you have enough money to get the next season out or the next collection. How has the sustainable approach? I mean, I don't really think that process is necessarily sustainable. One from just a creative design aspect. I don't know how a designer can continually keep coming up with fantastic work four times a year on that sort of deadline. So aside from that, how are you to building that into your business? Is that part of your sort of model as well?
We have like light seasonal guidelines, but we're designing for function, which is really helpful. Less for fashion. I mean, we take that into consideration, but things need to be functional. So weather requires different performance. And so we have that influence our design work for sure. And activities that are taking place in different weather conditions influence that as well. So I would say that those types of things are important to us in terms of seasonality. But we've definitely focused a lot on, you know, bringing things in that we think will make a difference in your wardrobe for real. And we test things. This was Nancy's genius idea. I'll let you speak to it.
Yeah. So there's two approaches that we do that get away from the huge inventory buys, which I think is a problem for all of fashion right now, and especially with the pandemic. And that is going to shift. So these huge fashion dumps of not knowing what it was and the big buys that you have to get in front of the customer and then the waste stuff that doesn't get sold is a problem in our industry overall. So the beauty about retraining the customer and the direct customer approach is that there's no store that you have to put 200 SKUs in to fill up. We can flow the product at a different cadence. We can release new product in July if we feel the customer wants it. When everything else is on sale, it could be new and it's a different flow. So we don't have to get into these huge risky buys. The two things that we've been able to do efficiently to help us with cash flow, and I think just again, not getting an inventory that the customer doesn't want or doesn't sell, is that we test things. So whenever we release a new product, we will do a small run. We'll talk with our factories. We get their buy-in and they say, this is a test. We really think the customer is going to want it, but we may only release like 100 or 150 pieces of it. We're not going to do a big buy. So we're going to put it out there. We're going to see what the customer is. And sometimes we don't get the product right. Like we know it's a good idea, but there was something not quite right about the fit or whatever it was. It gives us time to adjust. So we're not
get feedback with
1,000 units. It's great. And then the other thing that we do is that we pre-sell. So if we have a product, we relaunch it 2 or 3 weeks early and we pre-sell it before it comes in, which allows us to have a better cash flow situation. So sometimes we can, from a business point of view, we can have some of our landed costs paid for ahead of time. Plus it gives us a read on whether the customer really wants it. And if the customer really wants it and there's this big appetite, it gives us time to get back into a program with a lower risk. So those two scenarios from a business perspective versus where we came from before has enabled us to not be stuck on inventory that the customer doesn't want. Because that's the worst thing. It ties up your cash, it ties up your capital, and it's against everything that we believe in. So far, and we're young, but we have had very little product that we haven't been able to sell that the customer just doesn't want, that it hasn't happened to us. We've been very fortunate that way.
It almost sounds, I think it's a great idea, the testing idea, but part of me is really curious to how, I guess price incentive comes in from the people you're buying your materials from or who are making the clothing. You know, often you buy more, it's going to be cheaper to produce, correct? So when you're testing it, I understand there's definitely a calculated risk there in that. How are you sort of navigating that as far as dealing with like that little bump in cost?
So a lot of times we'll take a lower margin hit.
Yeah.
We'll take a margin hit at that beginning because it's better to take the margin hit and then know where your costing is going to be when you do your larger volume than it is to sit on a huge amount of inventory that you can't sell.
Yeah.
So a lot of times we're like, okay, I think she needs this. I know what we can get our costing. So we will take a lower margin. Or a lot of times if we have, you know, programs that sit at the factory, they're willing to produce the smaller amount of units at the same cost as their minimums. We also, we choose on purpose to work with partners where the minimums are not high. So we have not moved any to factories where they have super high minimums, because that's not where we want to get into or get into a risk with our brand of buying inventory and then having to be forced to sell product or has sit on it that you can't sell. So we purposely work with them and then we'll sell out. That's another thing. We'll sell out and it may take 6 weeks for the customer to get it again. And if she wants it, she'll wait. The other thing that we've been able to do on certain core colors is that we will platform fabrics. And again, our fabric selections are really tight. So instead of having, you know, 20 different fabrics, we have 5, and we will go ahead and buy 6 months worth of this fabric and have it sit in the factory. Then we can see what the customer wants and put it into the right products that the customer wants. And then we can move a little quicker to the market that way. And that's been another way we've tried to mitigate the risk and work through from the business constraints of growing a company, because the bottom line with fashion is that it takes a lot of money because you have to buy the product. And then you have this float of when you get the return back. And so it is a cash, it's cash is king for us. It's challenging.
And Hannah, you brought up feedback, which I think is really important. To me, it's telling me that you're listening to your customers, which I think is crucial for brands. You know, where are you getting that feedback? Is that Instagram or the email on you? Do you just get it? Are you seeing that feedback in your returns?
Yeah, I would say that Instagram for sure. We get comments and feedback and requests, which is really fantastic. And when we have new followers on Instagram, we reach out to them right away and start communicating so that we can start learning, like, why are you engaging with us?
Oh, really?
So when you have
new followers, you literally reach out and contact them.
Yeah. Just like, hi, what do you like about us? What are you looking for from us? Essentially is what we need to know. And sometimes we get great information. Sometimes we don't, it doesn't matter. I mean, I feel like the point is, you know, we started this business because we wanted to also build a community. We figured there were more women like us who are busy. Mm-hmm. And just need clothes that work for their lives better. And so it's like exciting because they're part of our community. And then I would say the other major channel, which I think is another stroke of genius, is that we got some advice to keep our shipping in-house, which means our returns are in-house, which means we have all that information at our fingertips on the daily, on the hourly. And we have the most phenomenal customer service woman on the planet, Karina. Shout out to Karina. She's a goddess. And not only does she give like the best care and love to all of our customers, but she, you know, shares feedback, requests for colors, new sizes. You know, we've expanded product assortment, color and size range because of customer requests. And that is what we're looking for. We just want to know what people are wanting from us. And then, you know, we'll often like tease product launches, and our pre-order program helps us understand, you know, what is she liking about it? You know, what do we need to do differently? Maybe if we were to place an order, you know, if the fit wasn't right on this one, what could be different? What length do they want?
I have a funny story. I have a funny story I'll tell about Hannah, is that when we first launched, it was, and we got our digital marketing going, and all of a sudden we had a few things that took off, and Hannah was like, oh, I like this. I want to talk to the customer. I know this is great. So we were going on, and then all of a sudden the sales kind of, we had a 2-month period, like it's kind of skyrocketed, and she's laughing. She's like, No, I like to do this. And then all of a sudden it was like 4 or 5 hours a day where she's communicating directly with the customer. And I'm like, clearly we did not have this vision of what it took to grow a brand and that we would spend half of our day dealing with all of this. It was pretty funny. And the realization that we needed to have a team that could help support us. But the early days, you know, like 3 years ago, the customer was talking directly to mostly Hannah and me, and we were trying to do it all.
And so how have you grown? How many people do you have working with you now?
We work with a lot of consultants. So Nancy, while you're thinking about that number, I'll just give some context. Because it shifts, right? Depending on what we're doing, we're able to increase when we have a busier moment and decrease when we don't. Or for example, when COVID hits, we're able to change the amount of hours they're working for us and what they're working on. Do you know the number, Nancy?
So we have 8 contractors that have been on our team for a pretty good stretch. And I have to say my shout out is that a lot of them are moms and they have to fluctuate their hours and they can work virtually. Some of our team we have never met. We've worked with for like 4 years and it's been Zoom conferences. They sit wherever, you know, wherever they live. And then we have a team of 6 to 7 high school and college students that help us do our shipping and receiving and logistics part of it. So we work a lot with youth that are interested in startup businesses or fashion, whatever, and they come in and they do anywhere from a 3 to 5 hour window fluctuating around their class schedule. And that's how we've been able to do the shipping and receiving and logistics in-house.
And that's smart. It keeps your overhead down too by sort of flexing as the need arises and keeps your sort of cash flow a little bit more free. Hannah, I apologize. I also cut you off.
I know. And I'm sorry. I wanted to interrupt because I think that this is such a, you know, because we're small and because we operate like this, it also allows us not to let people go because of economic situations, 100%. For example, like COVID. And so we're really grateful that we were able to keep people employed, but still work within a framework that was reasonable for our company. And so mm-hmm. I'm so glad that we weren't in a position where we had to do layoffs, furloughs.
Yeah, it's terrible.
We kept all of our contractors on. We reduced, they were happy to reduce a little bit, but I think we only reduced at the most 20%. But mm-hmm. we kept all of our contractors on through the entire, the early shutdowns were, I think, the hardest for us because there was more of the unknown. Mm-hmm. But it's been a volatile year with not just the pandemic, but then the protests and then the election. And mm-hmm. it's been so chaotic of a ride that we've had to, some days we have to check in like at 8 a.m. Can we send the email or can we do the post or do we have to react to this on a daily basis? There was probably 4 or 5 weeks where we as a team had to, jump on a call to see what our message was a brand. Throughout this last year, it's been just a hurdle after hurdle after hurdle that's demanded the team to work together for that.
Yeah, social listening is so important because it can really backfire if it's not done. If you email at the wrong time or post say the wrong thing, just because we're reading the news or paying attention to temperature checking your customers. I think that's really crucial when you. And I'm really curious to how you're building community within your business. You talk a bit about it within, outward facing with your customers, potential customers. How are you building your team and community culture inside of it? We're hiring now. And this is something we talk about a lot is what's the onboarding process? How do we find people that fit within our organization and, are not necessarily the same mindsets. I think having diversity in thinking is great, but are they going to play well? Are we going to play well together? Do they have the same values? So I'm really curious to how you're navigating that as you work with different consultants and contractors, and if you have any sort of unique proprietary things you've instilled in your business. Since the beginning.
I think we're at a place now where we really are challenged to do that. We had set out for 2020 to be more of that team building, and we had a lot of large goals, and then the pandemic has actually set us back a lot. And we just mm-hmm. realized too that what little bit of time that we met in person or we had that really got stripped away with the pandemic. And we recently I've been talking even through the holidays of doing a Zoom with everyone that works with us, because we have so many people that have never met mm-hmm. other people. And then everyone's burned out. So it wasn't appropriate back then, but moving forward, those are things that we're looking at. We have kind of a brand, Hannah does an amazing job, and I'll turn this over to her, but for each seasonality or each time we have a mission, we do in two different groups, everyone on our team, but you can talk to that meeting because I think that's important for them to understand the messaging for the brand.
Yeah. I mean, I think that overall, just in terms of what we consider when we're hiring, is that we are a startup. And in order to do startup work, you have to be comfortable with change and you need mm-hmm. to be comfortable with wearing lots of hats. Mm-hmm. And so I think just in terms of good fit, that's the number one thing that we take into consideration. Mm-hmm. And I think that also in terms of, something Nancy mentioned earlier, we do love working with, women that are parents, because a lot of the time, those are the women who have a ton of experience and don't have the time to do a full-time job. And so we love having a range of women who are in that life experience and working within their schedule. So I would say that something that's really unique to us is that we'll work within your schedule. Mm-hmm. There's room for that. Mm-hmm. And then I would say that Nancy and I come from a history of prioritizing fitness and wellness. And so she'll be like, I need to clear my head. Leaving at 4, going for a ride, or, mm-hmm. I'm going to be in late. I'm still working on this yoga practice, et cetera. So I think that there's definitely room for self-care and outside and fitness time on your own, especially during the pandemic. It's more critical than ever. And we really encourage people to do that. And then I would also say that, we want an environment where people can share their thoughts and their ideas. And so we definitely have very collaborative styles of working with each other, which is really great. But there's, like Nancy said, there's so much more that we want to do in terms of team building that's been interesting because we do have so many people who work remote in different places across the country. So we're still getting creative about how to effectively do that.
A fun story about one of our main primary investors who is on our board. She's this badass Ironman triathlete, crazy. Mm-hmm. Some people go out for golf dates. She tags me for hill repeats and bike rides is how we catch up. And we usually do that like once every 3 to 4 weeks. Like we'll just go out on a 3-hour bike ride at like, you know, 1 in the afternoon. So that's our golf date. It's awesome.
3-hour bike ride. You must be in amazing shape. I think I would keel over in three hours. That's impressive. Especially the hills of San Francisco.
Yeah. Especially when you're doing hill repeats with like this insane Ironman triathlete. She kicks my butt every time.
Wow.
But it's awesome. It's like, those are the things that are really great. And Hannah teaches a lot of yoga and has been gifting community classes out from our brand. And that, I think, is just an amazing gift to give as well.
So I would love to hear about, so I have a co-founder. I founded the business with a co-founder. I knew him previously. We were both photographers, directors working in the same market, and we developed a friendship. And there was a defining moment actually that where I was like, this guy is reliable, accountable. And it was a simple thing. I was moving to Los Angeles and I had to pack up and get a bunch of stuff into a storage locker because I was actually going to be in Korea in between that for a month. It was just kind of chaotic. And out of all the people I asked, he's the only guy that showed up and like put in the work. And it was just moving out a lot of stuff. I had way too much stuff. In that moment, I realized like this is someone you can count on. And so when I start kicking around the ideas of a business and business partners and that kind of stuff, he's the first person that came to my mind. What's your background? I would love to hear the story how you two met. If there was sort of this defining moment where you're like, yes, I think we would work beautifully together, because it's difficult. And I tell a lot of people like, I don't recommend people to go in business with their families. I mean, it's wholly up to them, but I think it gets really dicey because then you're really mixing a lot of personal and work things together. But I would love to hear like your story.
I met Hannah by a photo at her desk. So we both worked this corporate job together. And my first day, they brought me in. They just kind of brought me in and nobody knew that I was coming. And so I had to sit at desks where people were on vacation, and I floated that way for a month. And so my first day in, Hannah was on vacation for a week, and I sat there and I had this beautiful photo of her and her family. And she was this myth because everyone kept saying how much I would love Hannah. And that was what, 13 years ago?
Oh my God, I think so. We've been friends for a long time.
Yeah, maybe longer, maybe almost 15 years now. Yeah.
I think it might be 15. Yeah. Yes, we've been friends for a long time. And, you know, I think that you're so right. Like there are really specific qualities that make somebody a good business partner. And it's not just anyone. And, you know, Nancy and I always joke that like we started this business and we didn't realize we were also getting married.
Exactly. It is. I mean, it's a serious relationship. You know, people to count on you, you have employees, you have to count on each other. And there's this level of, I think, communication that is required that it can be really difficult to have with people that you're either not comfortable with or, you know, ones where that it just hasn't even been established on best way to communicate. How does that person receive what I have to say in their best way, you know? And I'm curious if you have any advice for people who are out there with business partners or thinking of having a business partner.
Oh my God, I couldn't do this without you, Nancy. I love you literally to the moon and back. The amount of respect I have for what you do is like unspeakable. I think that respect is a really key element of business partnership. And I think that vulnerability is actually a really key element of business partnership. And I think that, you know, we have both seen our best and our worst sides in this process, and we will hopefully continue to help each other grow. But I think that if you're not like our worst moments have always been the ones where, like, you know, I haven't been able to really like share what I am needing to communicate or vice versa. And I think that our best moments are when we're both able to like really show up and be transparent. So I would just say, like, I'm a big believer in business partners. And I also feel like you just got to be a really amazing communicator and like, don't be afraid to get support in becoming that amazing communicator. It helps mm-hmm. every other aspect of your life. And just thank you for being my business partner, Nance.
I couldn't imagine doing this journey alone because it's so hard. Like the brick walls and the hurdles every day. And so to have a partner that shows up or you can talk through those hurdles is huge. But I also feel like where we get into trouble is when we lead from fear. So mm-hmm. I think you have to lead from love first and let the fear go away, because that is the worst part of the business and growing it. And you can't come from a fear base of failing. You just have to come with this love of your mission and your brand and your partner and take it day by day as it goes. Mm-hmm. And then the other part is be willing to get help. Like when you have hurdles and people outside and coaching and, you know, better ways of communication, we all have the ability to learn. And I think that this starting a business and being in the rawness of it all forces that part of it. Forces that part, and the ability to learn is amazing. So don't be afraid of that, and don't be afraid to fail.
Well, I think that was really beautifully said. And I want to end it here because I think I would love just to end on such a positive note between the two of you. And I think one, thank you for sharing, and thanks for sharing the vulnerability, Hannah, in saying something as nice as that was to Nancy. And thank you both for coming on the show and sharing your knowledge and your journey. And I'm really excited to see how you two progress and build this business. I think there's a lot of great things coming for you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for the time.
And there you have it, everyone. Nancy Taylor and Hannah Franco from Epoch Evolution. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. Please shoot me an email, jweareunconquered.co, if you have anything you want to hear specifically. You can also head on over to the Apple Podcast app and leave a review. Until next time, this is Jonathan Hansen.